Get Technically Legal, where we examine the intersections of law, technology, and culture as we know it. Today, we have a very, very, very special guest, Mr. Chris Alexander. Chris Alexander is the director of the Office of Cannabis Management for New York State. Without further ado, how you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well. So glad to be here with you, Josh.
Man, we're so happy to have you here, man. Got a lot to talk about today. Obviously, the topic of marijuana, very interesting to everyone, just kind of seeing what the legalization looks like, when you're not doing it the legal way, what's some of the ramifications. But first off, we just want to know a little bit about your background. How'd you get into this space? Is this something you knew you wanted to do since you were young, or something that came all of a sudden? But we just want the perspective as to like who you are, and some background information.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely did not see myself working for a decade on this issue, but it has been an interesting journey. Actually started my professional career doing a lot of political organizing, running political campaigns on the state, local and federal levels. Eventually, I decided to, you know, take up issue advocacy and really spend a lot of time working on bringing an end to stop and frisk here in New York City, and the marijuana arrests that were resulting from those interactions. And then eventually I ended up building the statewide campaign to legalize, running that campaign and drafting what would be the most comprehensive and progressive legalization bill in the country, the MRTA, the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act. Went into the legislature, was in charge of criminal justice issues for the state, as a counsel in the New York State Senate. And then came back in and got the call to now run the agency and the industry that, you know, I designed. So that was a long pathway, but it started really with me just taking an interest in, having a voice and giving a voice to people who oftentimes didn't have one.
No, that's interesting. So for many people, you touched on how working through an agency, right? A lot of people don't know how agencies work on behalf of the government, what it looks like. Could you take us a little bit into the mechanics of that and what you do on a day-to-day?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so, you know, in addition to what people see kind of the public-facing thing, which is, the products themselves being offered for sale, and there is quite a bit in involved in running a state agency. I am one of a couple dozen commissioners. Our 60 or so state agencies, all offices that have a particular charge or mission. So State Department of Health, Department of Tax and Finance, Department of Labor, these are all other agencies in the state, and they all have their own charges. For our agency, for OCM, we are responsible for the regulation of the medical cannabinoid, hemp, and adult use cannabis programs in the state. For the day-to-day, I mean, we of course give out licenses, and today's a special day because it is the opening of our general license application window. But what we also do is, we kind of run a mini FDA, right? Like we ensure we license labs to do product testing. We review the certificates of analysis from each batch of cannabis products before they hit the market and decide whether or not that product can move forward. We do regulatory compliance to make sure that the cannabis is being cultivated and processed in an appropriate way. That's not going to create any adverse reactions for consumers. We also do quite a bit of public health messaging and campaigns to help change and undo stigma related to cannabis and cannabis use, but also to make sure people know how to use properly, responsibly, keep products away from kids and pets, etc. We've launched now two of the largest public health education campaigns in the country related to cannabis. And what I'm most excited about, what we've just recently done, started to expand and make available research opportunities here in the state. As you know, due to cannabis's federal status as still illegal, there's not much research except limited research programs done through the Fed. And so we're the first state to take that on head on to license folks to do research. And so it's a lot engaged there from compliance to public health and campaigns and external affairs. We are very public-facing agency, so we do a lot of organizing across the state to make sure people are aware of the opportunities that we're creating. From a day-to-day, I do run pretty significant programs, but I also have a large staff here to manage. We've got probably about 160 or so people across three offices across the state that I have to manage and make sure they all get paid and are able to, take time off when they got to go watch the kids and all that stuff. So that's also a part of it. I hope that wasn't too long-winded.
No, it was perfect. And you touched on a point. You said the stigmas around marijuana and education and public health. You touched on these points, right? So as you know, as a black man, me as well, there's always been stigmas around marijuana in the black community, right? You have some people, I'll say different perspectives, right? You have some people who love it, can't live without it. But then you also have other people who don't necessarily have the same relationship, right? And a lot of this may be due to past drug laws, where we've seen it incarcerate, family members, relatives, friends, spouses, so on and so forth. In what ways are the agency looking to, one, acknowledge it, but two, kind of change the thought process and the perspective around marijuana for those who don't see it in a positive light within the black community who've been affected by it in an adverse way?
Yeah, well, it starts with education. One of the things that I learned organizing around the state really on the issue was that a lot of, particularly, black elders had really negative opinions of marijuana, not because the plant was bad. Many of them had used cannabis and marijuana previously, but it was because they knew that it would, put the target on our backs. They knew that the odor, they knew that, law enforcement would regularly use the odor of cannabis to go after young people of color. And so part of what's really important and unique about the work that my office does is that we don't run from that history. We don't run from the state's history with prohibition. In fact, we lean into it and we make sure that it guides our work today. Just yesterday, we released a map, essentially. It's a map that changes over time that identifies the communities that were hardest hit by prohibition and its enforcement, right? And what you look as you track that map, you see all the black communities across the state, and you recognize that this is where the concentration of this activity happened. And we use it to not only prioritize certain people in the licensing process, which is unique and something that New York State is doing that no other state has done, but also will guide where we give revenue out, because also unique in New York is that we have a significant amount of revenue that's going to go right back to communities who have been impacted. Because we understand that, the effects of a cannabis arrest wasn't just, jail time or whatever. It was also a loss of economic mobility for an individual, but also for a family. And so something that we're really proud of is that we don't run from that history. We lean into it and we let it guide our work.
Now, how would people, we often hear these organizations say, hey, we want to definitely help people who've been on a marginalized end of these strict drug laws or in just other spaces where people that are marginalized, hey, we're going to come help you. And oftentimes the help is there, but we don't always know how to tap into that help, right? Because it's not always marketed or broadcast in a way in which we find tasteful. So how do people find some of these opportunities to tap into from a marijuana standpoint? And is there any opportunities, I think, for people who don't come from a lot of money to say, hey, I want to tap into this business or I want to tap into this work in a legal way?
Absolutely. So I'm going to start with the licensing side. One thing that I would always say as we ran across the state and did this like public education tour around licensing opportunities is that this would not be an opportunity that people don't get because they didn't know. Oftentimes, like you said, government will create these programs to help people, but they do such a poor job of bringing awareness to those programs. And so we had to start on the ground. We'd start with trusted validators, with organizations that are really doing the work in the community, and we partner with them. We host events with them. We add them to our mailing list and make sure that they are amplifiers of everything that we're doing. It has to be organic, and it has to be from the bottom up. And that's something that actually has been really successful, not only in terms of attracting people to apply for licenses, which, is the core component of it, but also in, getting people engaged with government in a different kind of way. There's a thing called a public comment period where an agency will put out rules for whatever work they do, right? So for us, we put out regulations and we asked the public to give us their feedback. What I'm so proud of is because of how we've organized and because of how we've elevated and made made community participation a focus of our work. We get more comments than any other agency in the state because people are committed and engaged in the work that we're doing, and because we've taken the time to educate. And so that's something that we've done that a lot of other agencies are trying to lean into for those particular programs that really impact the broad swath of New Yorkers.
I understand. And one of the things, I mean, how do you think that we'll ever really see true regulation? And what I say that by is, for a lot of people that I knew growing up, buying marijuana, for example, was a lot like going to the barbershop, right? You go to the barbershop, you sit at the guy you get your hair cut from for the last 15 to 20 years. That's who you work with. He knows you. You know him. You don't even have to tell him what you want. Sometimes you just sit in a chair. And I think buying marijuana is very synonymous with that, right? You knew a guy, you grew up with him, went to school with him, you've been working with him for years, right? And we talk about regulation, but how do you even change the culture of how people buy marijuana?
Well, what's happened across the country as we've acknowledged the economic impact that the industry can have is that, folks who have more resources, more capital, they've been able to buy up market share, right? And so, this company A, as whatever state legalizes or expands a medical program, whatever, they end up being the place to go for marijuana, the M&M store for marijuana, right? And everybody comes to them, and it's impersonal, and there's a disconnect between the product, the culture, and the people. What we've done differently is we're licensing your weed guy. We're giving him an opportunity. We're training him and teaching him how to run a compliant business, and then we're giving him the license to run it and the keys to the store. And so, our hope through our efforts, for example, our first retail licensing program was, again, something that nobody's ever done or tried to do. We made it a requirement that in order to be eligible for these initial retail licenses, not only were you supposed to be from certain communities, but you had to have a conviction in order to be eligible. And so by doing that, what we were saying pretty outright was those who were impacted need to be able to run and participate here. But what we also found is a lot of folks who, had either did time or had, just previous convictions for marijuana offenses, usually sale at a low level, went on to own and operate other businesses. And so they own and operate other because they had that business acumen, and now we gave them a chance to step back into something that they had previously done and to run a marijuana business and to essentially close the circle and get that interpersonal, that communal sense of cannabis, like get it back into the business. And so it's actually proven really successful for the stores that we have open. We've got some other challenges that have kind of stalled our program right now. We've got some lawsuits, et cetera. But for the folks that we've been able to get open, they're doing incredibly well, and they're doing well because they have a true connection to the community in which they serve and which they operate. And that's really the goal of the broader retail program.
No, I definitely think connection is important. I think the next piece is to switch gears a little bit. Obviously, tech is amongst us, right? Do you see a future where big tech is more involved, right? Whether it be from delivering marijuana, whether it be from the Amazon stores being able to have it and being able to distribute it, specifically in the state of New York, is there a place for technology in all this from the standpoint of either delivery or even selling, if you will?
Well, there's definitely a space for big tech. We can't ignore the future as it comes, and there's definitely a space for technology companies and innovators to support the businesses that we're creating. But what will not happen is we're not handing over the industry to these companies to run. We are in being super intentional about ensuring that these small family businesses really are the ones who lead in this space. They're going to be supported by technology through and through, and we've already seen some incredible innovation on that side. But for the most part, it will be small businesses in New York. That's our design, that's our structure. They are, of course, major tech companies trying to find their way in other states and in other markets. But in New York, we're definitely a small business focused type program that is supported by technology, not run by it.
You know, that's good to hear. So So one of the things, you can't turn on the TV nowadays and not see an advertising talking about fentanyl, right? And when I look at these regulations and hoping, you know, things get better and people kind of fall into line with the more legalized approach to purchasing marijuana, how has fentanyl kind of like affected what you do on a day to day? Do you see it, you know, causing any issues or restraints in what you do? And how, what problems or non-problems have it caused? Or has it actually helped you, right? Because now we're having and seeing more responsible awareness around, you know, intake to substances.
Well, before I stepped into this role, I mean, I did work on drug policy more broadly. And so I'm a big advocate for drug testing. For people who use drugs, you know, being able to test those drugs is incredibly important. And I'm really pleased that over the years, the state has taken on that position as well, as someone who formerly advocated for those positions. The truth is, even though it is very clear that with a lot of the illicit products, and I gotta clarify this because this is a kind of a big sticking point. The problem with continued illegal activity as it relates to marijuana sales is not that, you know, we're concerned entirely about you know, people, you know, dying, particularly from the illegal sales. What it is, though, is that the continued legal activity that is hyper-commercialized means that that local dealer, that friend, that relationship that existed doesn't exist anymore. Instead, we got, you know, illegal shops who are not focused on the individual consumer relationship. They're just trying to sell product to scale. And as they're trying to sell product to scale, they don't know where their product is coming from. And so whereas you might have had a friend grow some and then, you know, would distribute, now you've got folks getting boxes and shipments from the West Coast, from this place, that, and we don't know what is in those products. And so I want to be precise when I talk about, you know, illicit sales ongoing. I don't care about the corner boy. What we have a problem with is the hyper commercialization of illegal activity, whereas where the folks who are engaging don't care about the consumer. Now, as it relates to contaminants, those products have been riddled with contaminants forever. We've done reports. I've done a ton of public education and had quite a few public statements about the fact that the products coming in through illicit market, through these illicit storefronts, are, you know, heavy metals, salmonella, like all sorts of weird stuff that people shouldn't be consuming. I have not yet seen, despite the reports that, you know, folks have been saying, there's not yet been a case of cannabis laced with fentanyl that we have seen in the state. Right. And so there's been a correction of the record, still not good for you. And you need to go to our legal stores. For those in Syracuse, we've got a store downtown, Flintstone, operated by a licensee by the name of Mike Flynn. That is a beautiful dispensary. And those products are legal. They're tested. They're safer for you. You know, and so that's where we want folks to go. But I cannot say that we've seen, you know, a whole bunch of people getting sick from fentanyl in either, obviously not in legal cannabis, but also not in the illicit product as well. That is just at this moment. I'm sure, you know, anything could happen, but at this moment we haven't seen that.
Right. So, and no, that's good to hear. And obviously New York is pretty new to this party of cannabis management and regulation. So what's some things that you've been able to learn legally, I guess, from, you know, the states out west that have kind of been in this space a little bit longer?
Well, I mean, you know, folks, particularly on the advocacy side, like to dump on the other states because, you know, there's still so little black and brown representation in the ownership. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that, you know, we are just, you know, between us, California, Massachusetts, Illinois, you know, few states actually committed themselves to those broader equity goals. You know, Colorado and Washington, they were just trying to sell weed. You know, they didn't really get. The evolution didn't happen where they understood the need to atone for past policies. Now, California, Massachusetts, they tried to kind of do these programs and get them off the ground, but they were working within an established footprint that they couldn't fully roll back. Now, we have benefited from the fact that we had a very limited medical market So there wasn't a whole bunch of existing operators that I had to claw away market space from. They didn't have a large footprint. We had, 100,000 patients in the medical program, 10 operators, they're producing at a small scale. So there's a huge market opportunity for everybody else, which means that our licensing programs could be more effective. There's tons that we've learned in terms of just regulation in and of itself. But in terms of like ensuring that there's like diversity and inclusion in the cannabis space, we are the pioneer in that. We are the ones who are advancing the rules that everybody else is watching to see what's going to happen in New York. And what I'm proud to say as of now, we already have the most diverse cannabis industry in the country.
Wow, that's great news to hear. Now, we want to thank you, Chris, for joining with us today. Super insightful, a lot of good information. For people who are more interested in cannabis and the regulations and the legal guidelines around it, where can they go to find additional information?
Well, the best place, of course, is cannabis.ny.gov, which is our state website. There are a ton of resources there. Right now, as you go to that website, you'll see a lot about our general application, which again is opened up today. We're encouraging everybody to apply for cultivation, processing, retail, and other licenses that are made available today. On social, you can follow us at NYS underscore cannabis on Twitter and Instagram.
Thank you so much, Chris. And audience, thank you guys again for joining us for another episode of Culturally and Technically Legal, where we examine intersections of culture, law, technology. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Have a great one. Thank you.